Roger Mell's new book, The End of Ice, Bearing Witness and Finding Meaning in the Path of Climate Disruption. We'll link to your piece. Over one-tenth of the global population could face drinking water lack by 2030.
The time is 7:59. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Next stop, at 8 o'clock, we have more talk radio with Cecil and Celeste.
Tune into KBOO Wednesday, July 24th from 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. for the 21st Annual Homelessness Marathon. Broadcasting from a different city each year and airing on non-commercial radio stations coast to coast, this annual marathon features live reports, interviews with advocates and experts, and calls from listeners all over the country. This year's programming includes the voices of youth, students, and LGBTQ people, panels on fighting evictions, transitioning people back into housing, and ending homelessness now. That's the Homelessness Marathon, Wednesday, July 24th, from 8 a.m. to 6 p.m., here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio and the Jazz Society of Oregon are proud to present the 39th Annual Cathedral Park Jazz Festival, July 19, 20, and 21 at Cathedral Park in North Portland. KBOO will begin the live broadcast Friday at 5 p.m., and Saturday's live feed will get underway at 2 p.m. That's the 39th Annual Cathedral Park Jazz Festival, broadcasting Friday and Saturday, July 19th and 20th, here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Good morning. You are listening to More Talk Radio here on your community radio station, KBOO.FM. And this is Cecil Prescott. I'll be joined shortly by my co-host, Celeste Carey. And if you are listening, via the World Wide Web at KBOO.FM. 90.7 in Portland, 91.9 in Hood River, and 104.3 in Corvallis, Albany. Let me give you our phone numbers in which you can give us a call. You may call us at 503-231-8187. And joining us this morning is a interview I've been looking forward to. Joining us is Professor Ruha Benjamin, Professor of African American Studies at Princeton, and they are a fabulous person, and which we will find more about her and the work that she is doing, something that we all should be aware of. Celeste first became aware of her work and said that we must speak to her because she is doing phenomenal work. And so it is a pleasure to have with us the Professor Benjamin. Let me tell you just a second about her latest volume. It's called Race After Technology, Abolitionist Tools for the New Jim Code. And in it, she investigates something that we are aware of, and in terms of programming, and we become aware of it over the years, more recently, 2016 election and Facebook and Cambridge Analytica and all of that, but in terms about how emerging technologies can reinforce white supremacy and deepen social inequity. So it's a pleasure to have with us this scholar with us this morning, Dr. Benjamin. Dr. Benjamin, how are you this morning? She's not quite here yet. We're getting her on the phone. I'm sorry. And we have a little technical issue here, a little feedback on the microphone, and our engineer is with Dr. Benjamin right now. And so you have me. So let me tell you a little bit about the book. In the book, Dr. Benjamin argues about racist programmers scheming on the dark web, but also talk about how we need to be aware of how racism is manifesting itself in this technology, and she calls it the new Jim Code, CODE. And she'll tell us more about that in discriminatory designs and code inequity with us. So again, Dr. Benjamin is a professor at Princeton University in New Jersey. And Dr. Benjamin, thank you for joining us this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Benjamin, you're doing amazing work, and I apologize until Celeste told me about your work. I wasn't aware of this amazing work you're doing. tell us, how did you, is this something you've been involved with in terms of an awareness from early on in terms of technology? And your own personal history is so fascinating too. Wow, you're an amazing person.
Thank you, and no apologies needed. We're all getting to know one another, so it's fine. And so, you know, I actually went to graduate school in the Bay Area at UC Berkeley, and I was in the sociology PhD program there. And my first year as a graduate student, I took an amazing course taught by Professor Troy Duster, and it was called The Sociology of Science and Knowledge, and it was one-of-a-kind course, and Professor Duster wrote a classic book called Backdoor to Eugenics, and one of the things that he was showing is how new genetics, new advances in genetics, although they weren't framed or intending to have eugenic implications and effects, they nevertheless supported various kind of eugenic ideas and practices. And so Backdoor to Eugenics was also invoking the history of Black people having to enter the back door of businesses and restaurants as part of Jim Crow policies. And so I learned from him, and one of the things that really drew me to the study of science and technology from a sociological lens was that it, in many ways, many people put science and technology up on a pedestal as if it is asocial and apolitical, and that unless you are trained strictly in a field in science and technology, then you have no business talking about it or thinking about it, even though it impacts your life, right?
Yes.
And so part of what I was drawn to is a kind of stubbornness. When someone tells me I'm not supposed to do something, then it gives me more sort of fuel to do it. I want to know, why is that off limits? So it kind of drives me to think about how so many people are left out of the conversations around science and technology. What constitutes good science? What constitutes good technology, even though all of these decisions are being made that impact our lives? And so for me, it's a question of democracy when in the study of this. It's a question of power, ultimately power. Who has the power to create these things that, you know, materialize, you know, in our lives, in which we sort of experience the effects of other people's decisions? And I think that has to change.
We're speaking with Dr. Ruha Benjamin, professor of African American Studies at Princeton University, and well, amazing person. And we only have an hour, so I'll continue. You know, you mentioned briefly, you know, there's this mythology about science just generally. It's supposed to be pure. Yeah. It's non-ideological. And I think, yeah. and as you mentioned, you have to be someone special to enter into this special club. So, you know, and if you don't have the magic words or the right, the right degrees, you're not allowed in the room to be a part of the conversation. And you
that's right.
And you challenge that in many, many ways, knocking on the doors. And we know also in terms of just generally, people of color and women are kept out of these things and have to break down the door a lot.
Absolutely. And what you're describing is not something that happened by accident or just a natural progression. It was by design. And so to the extent that science has become the new religion for some, it supplanted the authority of religion. Those people who were able to call themselves scientists and to speak on behalf of this new authority exercised power, what we would call epistemic power, the power that comes from producing knowledge. So if you, exactly what you said, if you're not part of the club, then you're also left out of that the power of knowledge construction. And so this is not to say, and so sometimes when my students, you know, sort of started getting part of the conversation, you know, the pendulum goes to the other extreme. So what we're talking about is not a complete relativistic approach to understanding the world. The argument is not that everything is everything, that climate change doesn't exist, that, you know, vaccines aren't important. So we could take the extreme version and say, well, you know, there's nothing true in the world. Everything is just up for opinion. And that's not the argument here. It's to say that good science, you know, is science that is grounded in an understanding the perspective that is producing it. So it's a stronger version of knowledge production that recognizes its social roots, as opposed to what the majority of people are taught to think of science, is that it floats above us in this kind of godlike position that sees everything and that is not attached to the social world, and that the people who do the science, they are sort of disembodied, and, you know, their experience doesn't actually influence their work. And so we want to have a more nuanced understanding that we are fighting for a stronger, more grounded understanding of knowledge production rather than a disembodied God view of how to think about the world.
You're listening to KBOO. This is More Talk Radio. I'm Cecil Prescott. Our guest this morning is Dr. Ruha Benjamin, author of Race After Technology, Abolitionist Tools for the New Jim Code. It's a recent volume that she published, in which she reveals to many, in terms of the hierarchy and the challenges that is faced by the technology that we are living with today. In it, she reveals about how we may become aware of the ideology behind it, and how to break down it, and how to challenge those things and create a new paradigm. If you have a question or comment, please give us a call at 503-231-8187. Dr. Benjamin, a little more specific in terms of what you write about in terms of this technology, and break it down how it continues to divide and the racial aspect of technology. You call it the brilliantly enough, the new Jim Code, CODE. Mm-hmm. How did you come up with that term, and its relationship to historically the separation of predominantly Black people here in the United States, separated from power and access?
Right. I wanted a way to talk about this broader phenomenon of discriminatory design, and they, like you said, kind of ground it in the racial history and the ongoing racial violences of the present. So to have in the concept a resonance with this history, and of course I'm a student of and a fan of the work of Michelle Alexander, who wrote The New Jim Crow. And I have a number of colleagues who have been trying to theorize, you know, various aspects of the technology-society intersection. So, for example, a colleague, Safiya Noble, has written a fantastic book called Algorithms of Oppression. Virginia Eubanks' book, Automating Inequality. I have a colleague, Sarah Roberts, who's written a book called Behind the Screen. Another colleague who's written about weapons of mass destruction, Kathy O'Neill. So all of these theorists are trying to give us a language to speak about this intersection of technology and society, whereas most people are ready and willing to think about the impacts of technology. For example, parents think about the impacts of devices on their kids' attention spans or mental health. And so we have a way of thinking about the impacts of technology. And what all of my colleagues and I are trying to do is to broaden that conversation to also think about the inputs, the social inputs to technology, to think about how society isn't just impacted by technology. Society impacts what technology gets produced in the first place. And I'll give your listeners a quick example that takes us a little bit away from the context of like gadgets and screens to give a concrete example of something that we've all experienced. So a few years ago when I was visiting Berkeley, by this time I was living in the Boston area, just getting used to the winters there. So I was in Berkeley in February, and I just wanted to lay down in the sun for a few minutes between my meetings. And I was sitting on a bench, and I was going to lay down on this bench, and I realized that I couldn't actually lay down on the bench because of the way that the bench had been designed, and it had been designed with intermittent armrests so that someone couldn't lay down. And so it occurred to me, well, you know, this is an interesting, especially in the Bay Area, where the homeless crisis has advanced in direct proportion to the tech boom. The greater the tech industry has, you know, sort of taken over, the homeless crisis has also increased. So this also tells us there's a relationship between innovation and inequity. It doesn't have to be that way, but the kind of default setting, when we just do business as usual, the greater we sort of invest in innovation without any social consciousness, then we also exacerbate inequality. So here I was on this bench trying to lay down, and I realized, okay, you know, I can't lay down, and I bet I can't lay down. They've designed this to prevent homeless people from laying in this area. And so I was a little paranoid, but I did some digging, and I found that actually this is a worldwide phenomenon of designing public spaces, and particularly public benches, in order to deter what people call loitering, right? And so, you know, I saw some benches in Helsinki that are basically like single occupancy benches. Only one person can sit at a time. It's that small. I found some benches in France that you actually have to, it's a cage around the bench. So you actually have to pay to get in the cage to sit on the bench. And in this case, the people in this town in France, the townspeople were so appalled that they forced the mayor to remove the benches within 24 hours, which also tells us that we don't have to just live with discriminatory design. We can organize and take collective action and push back against it, right? But then the most, you know, illustrative example for me is a metered bench, a bench that has spikes built into it. That you actually have to put money into the bench so that the spikes retreat. And I believe you get about 15 minutes and then the spikes come back up, right? And so this was created by a German artist to get people to think about this whole idea of the privatization of public life, where the bench becomes a metaphor for the way that we put spikes into our healthcare, we put spikes into our education, we put spikes into our politics, and the way that we design things implicitly to exclude and harm different groups. So where something can be nominally public for all, like this bench with the spikes, anyone can sit on it, but if you can't put that money in, then you're excluded, right? You're left out. And so this is something as simple as a bench. And what I point out to your listeners is that means that something as simple as a bench has values and politics built into it. And so the designers of that, whether the designer themselves or whoever commissions that type of design often, they have certain things in mind about who this is for, but also who this is not for. And so if something as simple as a bench has all that going on, then it's likely that much more complex objects, more complex technologies, have a whole host of values and politics built into it that are often hidden from view. So what my book, Race After Technology, is trying to do is trying to pull back the screen so we can see what the politics and the values are so that we can design differently. We can design with justice, with equity in mind.
You're listening to More Talk Radio here on KBOO Portland, 90.7 in the city. Dr. Benjamin, I thank you so much for coming on and sharing your information with us. I want people to understand that when we talk about this design and how there are implicit exclusionary means in these technologies, this is not new, and it has been common in other mundane forms of technology. One of them, and people will resonate with this, is the fact that in most cameras that we use from the 50s on to sometimes even now, the cameras themselves have difficulty registering darker skin tones properly. And that is
absolutely
a political statement itself, which says that the standard of lighting is a brighter, lighter, whiter complexion. And there's a movie called The Mother of George. I believe it's Ghanaian. I'm not positive, that I watched. And one of the things I interviewed the director about was the fact that this film made a political statement because it was lit to glorify and illuminate all the various shades of black skin. And that made it a social comment as well as a deeper comment that the movie had about families. So we take for granted that, like you said earlier, that science exists in a higher transcendental state wherein there is no bias. We are also not looking for boogeyman and therefore finding boogeyman. The fact that facial recognition was not able to differentiate between dark-skinned people tells us that we were both an accidental oversight, but also a deliberate oversight. And you capture the fact that there is not only a distinct, deliberate desire to design this technology so, but there are other tangential forces at play, such as the short time developers have to get work debugged, so to speak, and the fact that even though we work to get a very diverse workforce, a diverse workforce is not necessarily what's needed. What's needed is a human mind that understands the value of humanity. You care to comment on that?
Yes, absolutely. So many important strands. And I want to just thank both of you for engaging the work so thoughtfully. I really appreciate it. So to your first point about the kind of history of photography, I would encourage folks to take a look at the work of Professor Lorna Roth, R-O-T-H, who has wrote a really important article entitled Looking for Shirley, in which she talks about this history about the Shirley cards that are used in photography to calibrate lighting, and that yes. the original Shirley was a white woman, so that in the practice and the design of early photography, the norm against which everyone else was photographed and compared was this white phenotype, which would lead to the inability of these practices to pick up on darker shades. And it's interesting that the one of the main reasons this began to change, that is the design of this process began to change, was when companies were photographing dark wooden furniture and also photographing chocolate in order to sell it to consumers, and they couldn't pick up the chocolate and the dark furniture well. So it wasn't a bit changing because black people who were organizing to call attention to this were showing that their skin was not showing up. You know, their figures were not showing up. It was in order to sell products better, which reminds us about the larger political economy in which so much technology is designed, and the incentive structure that in terms of values, the profit value often trumps other types of values when it comes to inclusion and equity. And so this is something for us to wrestle with, and it goes to your point about simply diversifying the people who are doing this. If the incentives that shape the design process continue to prioritize the profit value over other kinds of values, it doesn't matter who is behind the screen doing the designing,
yes.
because their work is being shaped by the profit imperative, right? They're going to lose their job if they try to bring in other types of values. And so this is something we have to, yes, we want more diversity in terms of tech development in Silicon Valley, but that's not the answer to it all, because the way in which the economic imperative continues to trump other imperatives. And I'll give you one example, kind of bringing it into the tech space. Again, I mentioned my colleague's work, Algorithms of Oppression. She begins that book with a vignette about going on Google search and typing yes. in the phrase black girls.
Mm-hmm.
And what comes up are images and websites for pornography.
Yes.
And she explains that the reason why those are the first responses to the search is because the pornography industry has billions of dollars to spend to make sure that is what we see first.
Yes.
That is that Google is prioritizing the money they get from this particular sector over the effects of this being black girls being conflated with pornography in the search results. And it's interesting now, since Sophia's book has come out, we actually see different results. That is exposing that problem and holding Google account. Now you're not going to see pornography pop up. You're going to see all kinds of much more positive examples of organizations run by black women and girls, Black Girls Rock, Black Girls Code. And so it shows that we can design differently, but it matters what values is driving the process. And I think that example really illustrates our ability to shift gears.
You're listening to More Talk Radio. Our guest this morning is Professor Ruha Benjamin, author of Race After Technology, Abolitionist Tools for the New Jim Code. Give us a call if you have a question or comment. Our numbers are 503-231-8187.
Dr. Benjamin, could you repeat the author of the book, Looking for Shirley?
Yes, it's an article. It's a journal article.
Article.
You could probably download it for free online. Looking for Shirley. Her name is Lorna, L-O-R-N-A.
Mm-hmm.
Her last name is Roth, R-O-T-H. And she's a professor at Concordia University in Canada.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Mm-hmm. The challenge, it seems to me, and you and Cecil both discussed this at the beginning, is how to get a seat at the table in such an exclusive club, and how to, I hate to say this, but basically monetize or commodify our need for a more, I don't want to say humane, but I can't think of a better way to describe mm-hmm. it, a mm-hmm. more humane treatment of people of color, and especially black folks in technology. I mean, I want to recall something that Richard Pryor said many years ago.
Mm-hmm.
He was talking about going to see this movie called Logan's Run. And he said, I went to see Logan's Run and I didn't see any black people in the movie. And that's because white people don't plan for us to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And that is prophetic in the fact that this technology is putting us in an electronic ghetto. It's even more than it's more like an electronic gulag. Whereas at least in the ghetto you can have a semblance of freedom, you know. In a gulag, there's no delusion. How do we fight back? Because it's been made plain, like with Sophia Noble's work, that it has to be incentivized or monetized. Or commodified for the powers to be to take notice of the fact that we're being excluded, and mostly on purpose.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many layers to that. You know, just going back to the prior observation, Richard Pryor's observation is profound, because what essentially, you know, what is being articulated there is that the future is, you know, it's waging a battle over who gets to not only be in the future, but imagine and enact the future. And one way to think about, you know, the role of world building, because technological development is also another way to think about it. It's about building worlds.
Yes.
And for many people, we're living inside of a world, inside of the imagination of people who don't necessarily see us as fully human,
right?
And so partly, we're living inside someone else's imagination. And at the same time, we have so many examples of people resisting movements, both aesthetic movements like Afrofuturism, that is saying, we're not trying to be in your future or in your world. Mm-hmm. We are imagining and crafting a different world, so a parallel reality where the fact that black people are going to be in the future, and not just be in it, but actually shape it, you know, in a way that's livable and just, that has been an ongoing project even before the term Afrofuturism existed.
Yes.
One way we can think about what our how our ancestors survived, you know, is about this future making. It's about imagining a future in which slavery doesn't exist, in which Jim Crow doesn't exist. So abolition of slavery, now today prison abolition, so much of that movement building is about world making, enacting the kind of world we want to live in. And so yes, and on through one angle it looks quite demoralizing, right, in terms of who wields the power and the capital, but we know that throughout history there have been parallel forms of world making in which people have enacted different kinds of ways of relating with one another, organizing. Today, one of the most heartening developments, I think, is that there's a movement within the tech industry by tech workers which is pushing back against the ethos of their organizations and their companies. There's a movement around a hashtag called Tech Won't Build It. Tech won't build it. In which they're saying, you know, we refuse to build technology for ICE. We refuse to build surveillance technologies that are going to be used to continue to occupy black neighborhoods. And so this is not simply a critique from those on the outside. There are those working within these organizations and companies that are akin to conscientious objectors, you know, that are saying, you know, we, you know, you don't come to us with this. There are petitions, there are walkouts. And so there's a growing movement that I think we can both support and also try to think about what kind of protections do these people need, because a lot of the people who are organizing, there's backlash against them from, you know, the higher up. So you need whistleblower
protection. Yes.
Yes. And so there's a lot that can be done, but and I also just want to point out that we don't just have to focus all our energy on what's happening with the big companies and organizations, because there's a lot happening on the grassroots as well in terms of tech empowerment, tech justice. In most of our cities, there are organizations and collectives that are addressing a lot of the issues that we're raising, and so in some ways, people just need to you know, poke their heads out of the sand, take a look at what's going on, and like link arms with those who are working on these issues. And I have a whole list of these on my website under the resources page, ruhabenjamin.com/resources, with specific, most of the ones I list are national organizations, but some are local, and I'm happy to direct people to more local organizations on Twitter as well.
Excellent. Dr. Benjamin, in your writing, one of your observations is it's very important to get young people involved in coding. So there's a lot of a push to get urban youth involved in that. But what you said this morning and what I've read from you, there's more that needs to be done. So it's one thing to get our kids involved in that. That's very important. But as I think you suggested just now, in terms of the those who are part of that, there is a need to confront the ethos within that.
Yeah.
So how do you? What are ways in which you engage people, encourage people to participate, but not but also with a certain amount of integrity and be able to challenge the predominant ethos of that field?
I mean, it's a really important question, because oftentimes the first reaction when people hear just the idea of tech and equity, like hear these things in conversation, the gut reaction is to say that, you know, well, the public needs more tech literacy in order to engage, or we need to incorporate more tech training in schools. And this is not wrong to say this, but it's also only half the story. And so to the extent that, yes, many people could benefit from greater tech literacy, not simply to become cogs in the machine, though, not simply so that they can start coding away and basically materializing someone else's agenda, but so they can have the skills to question and critique the orders. And so just diversifying a workplace or diversifying a profession, let's say programming, is not enough if you're not empowered to actually question and critique and shape the direction of it. And so one thing I point out, you know, diversity in and of itself is not a straightforward good. You know, plantations were diverse.
Yes, they were.
But
not hierarchically. Yet,
exactly. And so we can have, you know, right now we have a lot of diversity in terms of who does the grunt work in terms of tech, right? And so that's why the book Behind the Screen is so important, because many of the people doing content moderation, the treatment of workers, you know, today, I'll just point out to listeners, today is a strike on Amazon Prime.
Yes, it is.
Coming out of Minnesota are striking. And so I would encourage listeners to follow up and don't use Amazon today or any Amazon products today and tomorrow, because the conditions in which people are working in very diverse warehouses, mind you, right, where, you know, the rate at which they have to package goods, you know, it's affecting people's mental and physical health. And it's just, you know, one of the posters that was really important that people, workers were holding up, it says, we're humans, not robots. You know, and so this idea of automation, in which we're not just producing automated technologies, but we're expecting humans to act like automata, right, in order to produce these things. All of this has to be questioned, and just simply diversifying and getting more, you know, ethnic groups as part of your workforce is a ruse. It's hiding the true nature in which power dynamics stay the same. And so this is what I mean by, you know, when we look at various professions where women have entered at a large rate, or Black people have entered a large rate, oftentimes the wages in those professions come down with the more women and people of color that enter it, right?
Yes.
So what we can imagine in the next 10 years is the more that coding becomes something that everyone can do, it's not going to be a high-paying profession anymore, right?
Mm. Well, much like Uber, if people would stop and think about it for a moment.
Exactly. And so the answer is not simply getting more girls to code or you know, more Black and Latinx folks to code. I mean, that is only helpful to the extent that empowers people to question the underlying power dynamics and the relative justice that's enacted through tech development.
You are listening to More Talk Radio here on your Community Connection, KBOO Portland, also known as KBOO.FM. Coming up at 9 o'clock, we've got the Old Mole Variety Hour, and then at 10, Locust Focus. 11 o'clock is First Voices Radio, focusing on global topics and issues of critical importance to the preservation of Mother Earth. Don't forget, you can hear all of these KBOO programs after they have aired on KBOO.FM or on iTunes and Google Play. These programs are made possible by members' financial support. Please come and become a member today. Go to KBOO.FM, use our mobile app, click on Donate, or come into the building at 20 Southeast 8th. Today we are speaking with Dr. Ruha Benjamin about her book, Race After Technology, and we're talking about the intrinsic and I guess I should say to many aspects deliberately embedded discriminatory practices in much of our technology today, how to become aware of it, what you can do about it, and basically how you can understand how to resist on another level, how to resist this form of oppression. And as Dr. Ruha says, this is abolitionist tools. You teach students this work. And so therefore, I'm going to assume these are young people who have a different sense of privacy regarding mm-hmm. technology, have a different sense of agency regarding technology, mm-hmm. and don't have some of the fears and apprehensions that people in their 50s and above may have, or you know, as some mm-hmm. younger people most do have these too. But how mm-hmm. do these students look at the way they can address this digital mm-hmm. discrimination? Do they see mm-hmm. their possible agency in it? Because you speak optimistically, which is good for us to hear, but I'm wondering how young people with a differently wired consciousness mm-hmm. Relate to this.
Thank you for asking that. Teaching is my number one passion, so any opportunity to talk about my students and talk about pedagogy, I welcome. So one of the interesting things, I think, in overall, not just with respect to young people, but I feel like in the last few years there's a shift in a more critical consciousness around technology. When I first started the book, I thought I would have to convince more people to mm-hmm. question technology, that mm-hmm. technology was not neutral, and that we should sort of even engage this thought experiment and these questions. And so I thought I would have to like do a softer landing part of it, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think in a combination of the Cambridge Analytica scandal and various things happening where we can see sort of what the ethos of Facebook is and how it's affected politics and so on, I feel like more of the everyday person starts the conversation already quite a bit more critical than I was expecting when I started this project. So in some ways that's a good thing, but mm-hmm. you know, some of my colleagues who are activists, you know, especially in the Detroit community tech justice space, one of the things that they're pointing out is that we have to shift away from just being critical and paranoid about technology and become empowered. So what does that shift from paranoia to power look like? And one of the tools that they've developed that I discuss in the book is called the Our Data Bodies Playbook, which yes. you can download free online. And this is a set of tools and workshops and questions in order to engage students, community members, your grandparents, whoever the case may be, to just begin to think concretely about the values and the politics that are embedded in, you know, the tech in our pockets, and the tech that we experience every day. And so one of the things, though, for students is that many of my students, you know, as you say, are coming to the conversation not just more critical, but also with the sense that they want to change things and they want to do better, and they want a model of tech for social good, which mm-hmm. in and of itself is great. But one of the things I spend a little bit of time talking about in the second to last chapter is this concept of technological benevolence, which mm-hmm. is this idea that we're going to use technology to actually fix our social problems. And, you know, in one way of doing this, it can actually exacerbate the problems we're talking about. If we put on the shoulders of technology and make technology the fix for so many deep-seated underlying historical problems, like we're just going to create an app for this or a software program for that. And so those initiatives, which you can imagine young people often being most excited about, right? Let me, yes. I can create an app to address bias, or I can mm-hmm. create, you know,
let me write a new algorithm.
Exactly. So this mindset, again, is what my colleague Meredith Broussard calls techno-chauvinism, this idea that technology is the be-all, end-all, like it's going to answer all our problems, rather than thinking about what more fundamental things do we need to begin to address in our social order, in our society, in our policies, in our laws, in which technology might play a part, but it's not going to be driven by some tech, you know, innovation. And so I would caution young people or anyone who's in the mindset of, okay, let's create technology for good, to really think about the role that technology is playing in any initiative and whether it is positioned as the engine or the driver rather than the social infrastructure as being much more fundamental to it. And so in the last chapter of the book, I try to give some examples that distinguish between technologies that are just reinforcing the problem.
Yes.
But on the surface, it might seem like good, but reinforcing the problem, and ones that actually are driving a much more radical, fundamental form of change.
You're listening this morning to Ruha Benjamin, who is the author of, and where's the book?
Okay. Race mm-hmm. After Technology.
Race After Technology. Dr. Benjamin mentioned actions that's taken place throughout the nation next couple of days in solidarity with Amazon workers. And there are a couple of actions in this part of the region, in Northwest Portland on Wednesday, and in Hillsborough. You may contact Jobs with Justice for information about those rallies, 503-236-5573 is Jobs with Justice phone number. And we have a caller who would like to speak with Dr. Benjamin, maybe? No,
okay.
we lost it.
Lost a caller.
But give us a call back at 503-231-8187 and we will go to you.
It seems to me it's really important that people have a well-rounded approach to technology. Students who are in technology especially want to not just write code, not just figure out algorithms to do stuff, but make social change. And that is perhaps they need some sociology courses as well. And I know one of the things that you do is you talk about the intersectionality of race, of class, of science, and you even mentioned earlier in the interview the fact that, you know, to even be admitted into these rarefied heights, you have to somehow find either an ally or finagle your way into the back door or just brazenly burst through the door, you know, to be included. And so let me rephrase this question. Is there a awareness and a movement to bring more sociology and humanities studies into the tech world so that we cannot design a program that's only going to essentially hasten our demise rather than ease our burdens?
Yes, and so it's such a vital question, and there's a lot going on, because in some sense this is an intersection or a field that has been around for a long time. It's called the field of science and technology studies, in mm-hmm. which I was trained, in which many of the people who have mentioned have worked in. Now, what's interesting is the more that these issues come into public view, from within the tech fields, there are individuals and organizations popping up that are laying claim and saying that this is what they're focused on, but they, in most instances, are not drawing around on this long-standing academic discipline and those of us who've been thinking and writing about these issues for a long time. So it's almost like they're reinventing the wheel over and over again.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And it's not simply about giving credit to the academic field that has been engaged with this, but it's indicative of the broader hubris within technology, that not
yes.
only is the hubris around the tech itself, but now when it comes to tech ethics, there's a new hubris that they can solve the problems that they have created.
Yes.
And that is an issue, because there are those who've been thinking and writing about this who don't necessarily have the capital to throw at a brand new think tank or a brand new ethics board. Mm-hmm. And so I think we have to be as concerned about those who are framing the issues of tech ethics, because oftentimes ethics, as I've seen it in the context of bioethics, when it relates to medicine, and here when we think of tech or roboethics, mm-hmm. you know, oftentimes ethics plays the role of just facilitating the easier development of whatever the field that they're attached to. So rather
yes.
than being critical or really being a powerful force for raising fundamental questions, the questions and the conversations are very, they're framed often just to make it faster and easier for the technology to happen and to win approval,
yes.
public
yes.
approval for it, rather than challenging it in a substantive way. And so I think we have to have our antenna up in terms of those who are laying claim to being an expert in tech ethics or an expert in, you know, these fields, especially when there are individuals who are working within them, because if they're not actually, you know, actively collaborating with and drawing on the academic field of science and technology studies, critical race studies, you know, the sociology, social sciences, where there's greater autonomy to raise the more fundamental questions and come up with solutions that aren't just about tweaking the edges of the project, but about trying to reimagine and redesign the groundwork for a lot of this stuff.
In other words, it gets back to the concern of what's in it for them to
yep.
do us right, basically.
That's right.
And we have to be smart enough to also call for whoever asks for leadership in ethics to do a lot of self-examination and be totally open to critique without taking it as some form of it's kind of like being accused of calling the race card, you know. It's like,
yeah,
if this is not ethical, it's not ethical. Don't say we're calling the race card because it's not ethical,
right.
You know.
Right.
Plain
and
talk.
And right now, many like computer science programs and, across the country have incorporated or are incorporating some form of ethical training of people for data scientists. So again, we have to think about what does it mean to like tag on a kind of ethics module or week onto something, and you say, okay, what's really important is your tech skills, and we're going to throw in a little bit of ethics so that you know you're aware of these issues. But if it's superficial, if it's short-lived,
yes.
In the way that it often is, let's say when it comes to medical training and mm-hmm. the role of race in medical training, where it's not given the seriousness, the attention that it actually deserves, And we're giving lip service to ethics in many contexts, or just kind of throwing it in there without thinking about how fundamental it is. Like, you cannot be a good data scientist without a thorough training in the history of, let's say, racism in this country or sexism in this country. It's not an add-on. It's fundamental to your thinking, especially to the extent that so much of your work is going to be impacting communities differently.
Many of us became aware more recently with the presidential election in 2016 in terms of how we are impacted unintentionally by forces that are outside of our outside of our control. As we heat up towards the 2020 election, and I'm just speculating right now, I don't know whether or not any presidential candidates are beginning to address these issues, or are those type of conversations taking place? There's a tendency to say, oh, you know, we get an instant fix and technology is the answer. So I'm just speculating right now. So if, you know, if a presidential candidate who also went to Spelman came to you and said, I need some advice, would you say anything, or how would you guide that person or someone else?
Yeah, it's a great question. And in fact, I have a colleague, Mutale Nkonde, who has been working on Capitol Hill with the Congressional Black Caucus and holding hearings and also information sessions to brief our senators and our legislators, to bring them up to speed about so many of these things. Because if you saw some of the hearings with Zuckerberg, it wasn't just Zuckerberg that was sort of falling short. The questions that were being posed to him also did not convey a really sound understanding of the issues or the technologies. And so my colleague Mutale, who I'll tweet her handle when I'm done with the conversation, she's been working nonstop with so many of our legislators to brief them and to get them up to speed. We have right now something called the Algorithmic Accountability Act that two of our Congress people have proposed, which gets at some of the issues. It's not it doesn't quite address the extent to what we've been talking about, but there are moves underway, and I think we will see this part of the conversation grow in prominence as the election cycle moves forward.
You know, there is so much more to talk about with this. We hope we can get you to come back again as a guest.
But I would love that.
Good. Any parting words to people? Because I'm assuming that we didn't get calls because people found this fascinating and maybe just didn't even know how to formulate a question. And I understand that. Any parting words for people?
Yeah, you know, I really always, both with my students and when I'm in various communities, really want to underscore the power of collective action to respond to the problems that we're discussing. When we only focus on the problem without really pointing out and highlighting our agency to fight back and to resist, not only to resist, but to create alternatives. So I will end with one local example to give people a taste of what I'm talking about. In St. Paul, Minnesota, there were several government agencies there 2 years ago, including the police department and the public schools there, that formed a controversial joint powers agreement, and they called it the Innovation Project, which basically gave these agencies broad discretion to collect and share data on young people, on students, with the goal of developing predictive tools to identify at-risk youth in the city. So on the surface, someone who is not, you know, really privy to all of the behind-the-scenes stuff that we're talking about thinks, okay, that's good. Mm-hmm. Let's have predictive tools to identify at-risk youth. But these agencies, both the police and the public school system, their track record is not good.
No.
With respect to how they engage young people. And so what they would do with this data is very concerning. So what happened was there was a broad-based backlash from the community. And in 2017, a group of over 20 local organizations formed what they called the Stop the Cradle to Prison Algorithm Coalition.
Hello.
And so what happened, they were successful in actually forcing the city to dissolve this joint powers agreement in favor of a more community-based approach. And so they're moving forward with that. But within a year, they organized and they stopped this data collection process, which they knew from, you know, past precedent was not going to ultimately serve their youth. And instead, they took the power back to determine how best to engage in supporting young people. And so this is an example you can look up happening in St. Paul, Minnesota, that I think can be a model for other cities going forward.
Thank you so much, Dr. Benjamin, for your time, your insight, your energy, your teaching, and the books.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. I hope to come back soon.
Oh, good. Thank
Take
you.
Care.
You've
Have
been
a great day. Take
you
care.
Too. You've been listening to More Talk Radio here on your Community Connection, KBOO. Please be advised, there is an African-American community in the park on Thursday, July 18th, 2009, at Lewitt View Park, 127th Avenue and Fremont from 4 to 8 p.m., an opportunity to connect, heal, and hope for people of color and Multnomah County service providers. This is your Community Connection, KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring for a membership director, a morning news and public affairs director, and an evening news and public affairs director. The deadline to apply for these three full-time positions has been extended to July 18th by 11:59 p.m. KBOO Community Radio is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. For more information on these positions and how to apply, just go to kboo.fm/employment today.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland City Council Forum on Zenith Energy's Tar Sands Terminal, Monday, July 15th at 6:30 p.m. at the University of Portland Buckley Center in Portland. An oil terminal owned by Zenith Energy in Northwest Portland is under construction to nearly quadruple railcar loading capacity at what used to be an asphalt plant on the Willamette River. At the hearing, community organizations are preparing to speak out against Zenith and call on the Portland City Council